This is the sixth talk in the series of Anatta Retreat, and the title is The Lights Are All Switched On, But Nobody's at Home. And it's really an exploration of what it feels like when the self kind of packs up and leaves and the house is empty, but the lights are all light and shining. And what's that about? So I want to start really with continuing exploration on experience, because it's the basis of what it is that we are exploring, what we're touching, examining together, and the basis of everything in our life, of course. And the first thing to emphasize is that an experience is put together by knowing, by the knower, and by something that is known. It happens more or less instantly. And it's one thing, an experience. It seems like one thing. Like if I'm looking at the cushion, really the looker and the cushion are two sides of the same experience. If the cushion could talk, it would tell you that it is being looked at. And I can talk and I can say, I am looking at the cushion. We are one thing from two sides. And we all come, an experience is the coming together of elements at the same moment, which are conditions, because of a great number of conditions that cushion exists, I exist, you are knowing this moment. It takes the whole universe actually of conditions for this moment to happen. And the thing is that all these conditions are not kind of floating around in the universe independent of each other. They are arising together. They depend on each other. The Buddha said, knowing, consciousness, and the known, namely nama rupa, are like two sheaves that of wheat that lean on one on another. You can't take one away. They all fall down. The consciousness arises when there is something to be seen, and the seen arises because there's consciousness to see it. And the two come together and we say experience. So things depend on each other. For example, my eye, your eyes, see light. But your eyes are built because of light. If there was no light, there would be no eyes. So the light builds the eyes build the light. This moment is built because we're ready for it. The brain is constructed by the world, and then sees the world. So there isn't a brain separate and a mind separate from the world. That's just sort of pre-existing, like a kind of machine that says, right, now I'm ready for the world. The world builds the brain and the mind and the person, and then the person sees the world in the way that the world builds it. The network, if you look at it in neurological brain terms, we know things because there's networks in the mind that are ready for those things. There's a network in the mind called tree. Therefore, when I go outside and see this thing, I know tree. But all the conditions in the past have created the network called tree. So the tree world has created me, and I'm creating the tree world. And we're all creating each other. Everything is codependent. There isn't independent things in the world that are standing alone. And it's really interesting to contemplate that also with the self, of course, because the self is built by the world and then thinks it's separate and independent. But the self is built by the world and then sees the world. And so the self is the world and the world is the self. Only we forget it. Right now, it's the world looking out of my eyes at you, and you are the world's looking out of your eyes at this bit of world. So the world looking at it itself. Only we all think we are something, separate, beings, separate. That's our problem. So everything is making everything else all the time. And that's why it's hard for us to find when we really look, and meditation is about really looking, it's quite hard to find anything separate really from anything else. And things that look separate tend to disappear with a penetrating gaze, a deep, steady, clear gaze. Everything tends to dissolve, mostly because it's not there in the first place. It's just a construction, an illusion. This is the real meaning of emptiness. Emptiness is not a thing. It's the total interdependent of all things that are there because they're made of all other things, and they're made of conditions, and everything is made of conditions which make more conditions. And so emptiness is not blank nothingness. It's a sense that there isn't an independent, standing alone things that are there by themselves, kind of standing alone, lonely objects. And if we understand that, then the bottom falls out of all of our constructions. We understand it, meaning we really see it and know it and are clear about it. Then the bottom falls out of our constructions. And that's a bit frightening. It means there's really, in the end, nothing to lean on. Surya Das, that once came to Israel, Dzogchen teacher, said, actually, when we look, we're all leaning on emptiness. We're leaning on nothing. There's just nothing to lean on. I'm trying to lean on something. I want there to be something around that I can really lean on, but because everything is constructed by everything else, there's nothing to lean on. Joseph had a nice image for this. He said, when you kind of really see it, it's a bit like jumping out of a plane without a parachute, which is really scary until you realize that there's no ground underneath. So it doesn't matter anymore. I like the Sometimes the Kabbalah, the Zohar, has beautiful jewels of insight. And it's interesting that the Ein Sof, meaning the highest of the Sfirot, of the Esser Sfirot, of the Tree of Life, it's the infinite. And the word, some of the words, one of the words given to it in the Aramaic is stima distimin, and it means stum. It means stum of all stum, achi stum that you can possibly imagine, which is beautiful. It's very lovely. It's like also the name of God. One of the names of God in the Bible, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. That nobody can even really understand where that's going, and it's not a reality. So, if we take out, well, we can't really do this, but if we take out the knower as an independent existing thing, which fundamentally doesn't exist. But if we look from that point of view of no me, or no enduring me, or no subject in this subject object, what do things look like? Well, to some extent we've been doing this. And we use the word witnessing, edut. Well, witnessing, it's not quite that, because in a way it still needs a point of view. Witness is still a point of view. We are something looking at and witnessing at. But shall we say, it's greatly reducing the place of the subject and increasing the importance of knowing. So I would say it's like 80% knowing and 10%, 20% the knower, instead of 100% the knower, which is the usual conventional way of looking at life. It's reducing the knower, the status of the knower greatly, and replacing it by a great deal of awareness. Still there is a knower behind it, so we call witnessing something. It does take a position, witnessing. And the beautiful phrase about witnessing from Nisargadatta Maharaj, the great non-dual teacher, who said, witnessing is the watchtower of the ultimate. The watchtower, the Amud Shmira of the ultimate, or Mukhlat. And it's a beautiful phrase. So it's not the ultimate, but it's definitely a great blessing to be able to witness, and this is what we're doing here. Because it increases the importance of the knowing rather than the knower. And we can explore more carefully what it is knowing when we look at it, when we explore it, when we witness things more. What happens? And one of the things that we begin to realize is that the knowing is fundamentally free. When I'm looking at that cushion there, knowing receives from the eyes colors, identifies with perception a shape, and a mental process which depends on pre-existing sankharas, constructions, engraved in the mind, identifies cushion. But the knowing that does that doesn't have cushion in it. Like, I see female and male. So when I look at female, is my awareness female when I look at female? And male when I look at male? Is my awareness cushion when I look at cushion? Or is my awareness reaching out and grasping and fitting itself into cushion and sort of becoming a cushion awareness? But that process is a process that awareness kind of wraps itself into cushion or collects itself into cushion or cup or female or light. So free awareness kind of gets captured by shapes and becomes them. It doesn't take away from the fact that when we explore awareness more and more, we see that it's free. Awareness cannot be the object. It's totally free. It's like water. And then the more we live with awareness, the more we become free like awareness. The more we live with awareness as our main guide and power for living, because awareness is by itself free, then we're free. And we will see objects and worlds and things. Doesn't stop us seeing, but we're free. It's a much more, perhaps, right brain way of being, less tied. The left brain tends to be the brain that would be more constructed by objects and definitions. This kind of sense of the knowing and living with more dominated or dominant, the knowing, the free knowing, it's not, and sometimes you've had this experience, it's not a kind of unconsciousness or blankness or dreaminess or cloudiness. It can sometimes be mistaken for that, because some of these states also of switching off feel like I switched off the world and so I'm awake, I'm enlightened. But awaking, being awake is awake, not asleep. So we have to be a little careful not to get it confused with states of not being or not knowing or even the unknowing. And I have, for years, I've been having wonderful discussions with a close friend of mine in Clear, Israel. And he takes very much an Advaita, a neo-Advaita, shall we say, not a traditional Vedic Advaita, but a neo-Advaita place. And so we have amazing hours of discussion. And sometimes we really find differences between his view of, he represents particularly Advaita, Neo-Advaita teachers like Nisargadatta Maharaj and myself. And I remember one of the big debates that we kept having, and we really didn't solve it, was he championed the not knowing. Iyadiya. Now I think that that's really valuable. It's not at all that I put that down, because in the process of discovering awareness, we do need to let go of a huge amount of assumptions and beliefs and things that we think we know as truth, including some very, very basic things like that is a cushion. And we forget how much that's a learned truth that we think we believe in, or how much I exist as a thing, a person with identity. We talked about it. You need a lot of taking that knowing to pieces and undoing it. Nevertheless, the Buddha never really supported not knowing, because not knowing or unknowing is avidya, is actually one of the sources of all our problem. And the clarity of a free awareness is to be known, and really known clearly. Avidya is wisdom, is a wisdom of awareness that is free and non-constructing anything. It doesn't get in habits of the construction business. So interesting. So I understand not knowing, but yet we have to be kind of clear that it's a different kind of knowing, a knowing that frees us. Very clear knowing, very awake knowing. But it may not be very exciting. When you think kind of free knowing, awakened knowing has got to be totally blissful. I don't know if any of you have had experiences of first jhana, meaning kind of rapture or bliss arising through states of concentration, but very quickly becomes a big headache. It's like putting your fingers in a plug and getting electrocuted. So kind of like this, and it's very, you think, oh, I want that bliss. Well, all the books are writing about bliss and pleasure and joy and ecstasy and rapture and so on. But when it actually happens, it's exhausting. You don't really want it anymore. It's much, much better to settle down into sviatratson, into some sense of just being fine, not having that. It's just problem to be electrocuted by bliss. So, but the sense of open awareness may not be that interesting, and I mentioned it today, like the space in the room, it's not so interesting. But because it's not interesting, it frees us. Because we, the consciousness and a free awareness doesn't keep selecting and choosing what it should be interesting according to conditioning and what I've learned in my life to pay attention to. So everybody tells me, I have to look at this thing, so I look at this thing, but not that, not that, not that, not that, not that. So we are constructed by the world, we're told what to be interested in, we're told what to pay attention to, and then we're stuck with it. And what is not that doesn't look that interesting. But of course it is, because living with spacious awareness turns everything interesting. Not just what it is that I'm told to be interested in, what is I'm supposed to look at, television for example, but everything becomes actually interesting, including the space in the room, or including the small flowers on the street in Tel Aviv when the buses are roaring past and no one notices. There's tiny little flowers that are trying to force themselves between the concrete on the side of the road, and nobody knows them because everybody's busy running after their shopping or their duties or their work or their getting to the car or complaining about buses or complaining about the Prime Minister. And No one sees little flowers breaking through the concrete. And no one sees maybe a small bird that's just hopping by the side of the road. Or the look in the eyes of the bus driver when you get on the bus, and how he might be. Or your feet, or the ground, or the sky. If it's a great sunset, sometimes people come to Klil and visit my place, and then there's amazing sunsets sometimes and sunrises. And they go ecstatic. What a sunset! What an amazing sunset! And I've never quite understood. Well, this sunset is amazing, but the one yesterday wasn't, because the color gray, now the color red, so wow. And the color gray, ooh. Well, the gray sunset is just, why is it worse than a red sunset? I never understood it. Beauty is everything, is everywhere. Where is there not beauty? Where is there not beauty? So part of this freeing up of the consciousness when it's less owned by a self and by conditioning is that we can begin to see more moments of space inside us. And moments of space, for example, at the beginning and the ending of a thought. Where the thought comes from and where the thought goes to is a really interesting and important meditation practice. A lot of non-dual teachers are really supporting that as a primary practice, because it opens up a space of a kind of knowing that is not trapped into forms of the known. It's like the silence that allows us to hear music. If there was no silence, we would never hear music. If there was no silence, we wouldn't be able to hear the words I'm saying, because the words I'm saying are resting on silence and potential. And if we are kind of reflective, we can be less interested and less captured by form, and more interested in what allows form, namely emptiness or space. And to use a very simple image, if someone knocks on the door and gives us a parcel, we can also say, no thank you, I don't expect anything right now, I don't want the parcel, I don't want the package. What happens? The package goes. If we regard the things coming into our senses as packages, we can also say, no thank you, that's fine, you can come and you can go. I don't need to take you, unwrap you, get excited about you, store you in my full house, which is packed with unwanted gifts. I could just say, yeah, sense object arrives, thank you very much, DHL delivers it, FedEx delivers it, and I can give it back. I just get more freedom that way. So there's stillness in that. There is a lot of peace in that. We might experience a kind of inner peace from not having to invest in believing in the known objects of the world, including the self. By itself it brings stillness. By itself it brings a sense of beauty. Every sunset is beautiful. By itself is also natural. We don't need to run out with a consciousness to grab everything. There's something very natural in just being at peace and not grabbing on and holding on with the consciousness to every sense object, the known. It's just not needing, it's a sense of not having to, because a lot of that grabbing that we do with the mind onto sense objects and the busyness around that is a habit, and it's exhausting. And we can just feel settled down, not disturbed. There's no friction left. When the self isn't dominant with its interests and needs and busyness, then there's no friction. Chikuch. And because it hasn't, there's no need to grab onto things in the world or reject them or send them away. The Tibetan image of this is called one taste, meaning there is a kind of everything is there in the consciousness, and impressions might arise and pass by, but the consciousness, the awareness is constantly there. So it's like everything has a taste, one taste. Taste the same, awareness. And it's in a way impersonal. When you get further than the witness, so we say we get 90%, 95% knowing, and only 5% knower, or 100% knowing, and 0% knower, then the experience is one of awareness knowing itself. That there's no one in charge, and awareness knows itself. It's Ajahn Amaro, I met him last year in Amaravati Monastery. He said, and it's a quote from Achan Chah, his teacher, it's like Dharma knowing itself. It's everything is Dharma. Then, because there's no importance of a separate being called me. And so everything turns into Dharma. It's truth knowing itself. It's truth, it just, everything becomes Dharma. Everything becomes truth. And truth is not something that you can grab onto either. It's isness. It's just sense of there-ness, sense of touch of things. In the Pali, there is the word tatata. Tatata is meaning tat, meaning that. It's like in English, that, tat. And it means suchness, isness. That's all. Because without a self, there's nothing else that you can say, that is said about things. It's other than isness, arising and passing of itself. Tathata, isness. And the one that realizes this, the Buddha, is called Tathagata, meaning one who has gone to that state, or who has come into that state. It means both gone to and come into that state of tatata, itself. And again, it's like the name of God in the Bible, Ehyé Asher Ehyé, which is impersonal. It's just isness. Is as it is. The world is. The world does itself. The world is as the world does. Nevertheless, I have to say that in all the various spiritual schools, including many Buddhist schools, there is a very big debate about how much this tathāta, this isness, is itself some kind of a thing. Sorry if I have to, this confuses everybody. But one of the language that is used for this, for example, is Buddha nature. That it brings a certain higher self into the picture. And the Buddha was really against this, but it does come in again and again, and I wouldn't sort of take sides on this. I would allow you to personally explore this whole issue, which is quite subtle. But we can understand that their sense of, for example, the Atman that is in the Advaita tradition as being something like a kind of ultimate self that knows, that the knowing is a kind of infinite self. And the Buddha nature is there as in many schools. And there is a strong attraction in words like ultimacy, the ultimate, hamukhlat, the reality, the source. There's a strong, and you know, I'm not going to take any position. The Buddha 2,500 years ago was quite against that. And he said, you just stay with the unfindable. He said that any time you create a kind of a thing, or a kind of even a higher person, or a higher thing called, even words like presence, which we're using all the time in mindfulness, or being, they tend to construct in the consciousness something, and that's based on dukkha. It's based on a fear of emptiness, or of unknowing, unfindability. So I just want to raise that, not as a philosophical issue here, but just to kind of raise it and leave it in a way hanging in space. But there are places in us that we might feel, yeah, there is something in me that is a kind of higher self, and I'm okay with that. For example, what is it that creates longing for liberation? What is the longing? Kamiha. What's the longing for liberation in us? What's the place in us that understands dukkha? There's something in us that is a higher being, if you like. We can say that. And maybe we can say it for a while and then just drop it. Nevertheless, when we, with a more spacious mind, a spacious awareness, less selfing, we still meet the world. We still get up in the morning. We still brush our teeth. We're not in some cloud land. We still go to the toilet. We still have grandchildren. We still need to eat. The Buddha ate, so he felt hunger. The body needs things, and all that's fine. So is that a problem? Does, from this spacious awareness, does life turn into somehow a problem? And the answer is no, because things then appear much more as everything happening by itself. Just like I don't need to regard my digestive system as a problem. If I'm fine relying on it and trusting it to do the job. Same with my body. But can we look at our mind like the digestive system? We just trust it to do its job. It picks up things, it drops things, it does things. Can we look at our life like that? It's happening by itself. I don't need a boss, namely a big me inside telling me what I do. Is it better to do this, or is it better to do that, or maybe I should not do that, maybe I should do, what's the best, what do they want from me, what do they want, what do they need, what do I need? If we drop all that, then things are much more like they happen by themselves. They happen because they need to happen at that minute. Food comes in, and the digestive system knows what to do. So we don't need to look down on the senses, on what's coming through the senses. We don't need to regard it as being something wrong with stimulation arriving through the senses. We just don't need to be busy with constructions coming out of that. Ajahn Chah said that the apparent, namely what appears, and the transcendental world, they just simply arise together. They're just one thing. What seems to be and the ultimate just arises in the same moment. And it really tells us that if we get confused by everything that's happening, including this talk, our solution is in the immediate moment where everything sorts itself out. If we really get close to the immediate moment, well, there really isn't such a thing as moment, because that's already time, but shall we say immediacy, miyadiyut, there we see both the passing and the ultimate. They come together. We don't have to have a theory of the ultimate. We don't have to have a Buddha nature up there in the sky. Because in the moment, it's all there. And all of this brings one beautiful movement, which is a movement of love. Because we're not machines. And the minute the self story and self interest begins to loosen and drop away, then we find ourselves in intimacy with everything else. And that's love. And there really isn't anything left to do in that place except serve, except feel compassion, except be with an open heart. There's nothing left to do, because you're not interested in me anymore so much as separate from everybody else. So it's just boring to kind of keep looking after yourself and looking after yourself, and what more do you want? What do you need? It's just boring. The whole universe is there, so you and the universe kind of joined, and therefore there isn't that much difference. And that's compassion, and that's the movement of the Bodhisattva. Like the Dalai Lama said once, it's so much more joyful to give to others than just to give yourself, because there's more of them. And you realize, for example, that at the beginning of the journey, you might feel, you know, it's my back that's hurting, it's my mind that's hurting, I've got all these stories, tensions, issues, memories, struggles, patterns, tavniyot, they're a big load I'm having to cope with. But slowly, slowly, if with this sense of not constructing a self around all of these things, letting go of the knower, dukkha, suffering, becomes impersonal. It becomes part of samsara. And it is part of samsara. It's not yours. You didn't invent suffering. Who wants that? The self didn't sort of get up in the morning and say, "Ah, I'm born like a baby. I'm born into this body. Now I'm ready. I want all the suffering that I can possibly have. I'm just ready for it. That's why I'm here." The suffering is inherent in samsara, in the wheel of life, in the fact that we're born into a body and we're struggling to live, like all beings. And like all beings, we suffer dukkha, difficulty, and dissatisfaction, and neediness, and having to struggle to live, like all beings. So it's not personal at all. And the impersonal nature of dukkha is a great relief, that we're not alone, me, as the victim, having to carry the burden of dukkha. And it leads to compassion, because we're all in the same boat. Dukkha is not personal. And it's one of the, in a way, fruits of reducing the power of the knower. And the realizations that come tend to be impersonal. They tend to be more universal. One of the realizations, and you're not going to believe me, but one of the realizations and understandings that arise is that there really isn't any difference between the Buddha and each one of us. It's only that we forgot that we're Buddhas. We just forgot. And we've kind of got covered by an illusion that we are struggling and we are self that needs to survive. And a lot of what we need to do is to simply uncover and drop klipot, the peels, the covers. I love the quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, which is perhaps his most famous quote, which is so beautiful about this, and really it's about the whole talk. He said, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. And between the two, my life flows." He said it in another way, slightly differently. "When I look within, wisdom tells me I am nothing. When I look out, love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows." We can't get there by force. We can't get there because, in a way, there's nowhere to get to. We can't demand to be there. We need to kind of let go of unnecessary things and let the realizations arise by themselves. In some way we are already there, and we just don't know it. So I want to finish with a couple of poems of my own that I wrote. A couple of short poems. "I put away the maps. I gave up asking for directions. After endless migration, I found myself back home. I couldn't find it before because I was looking out of it. Awakening isn't something, but in the search for it, we stumble between knowing and being, and accidentally fall into it, while accidentally falling out of everything else. And finally, I'd like to read kind of an instructional poem by Gendun Rinpoche that gives a sense of the non-doing or the non-effort that's needed for falling into awakening, stumbling into awakening. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever arises in the moment in the body-mind has no real importance at all. It has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with and become attached to it? Passing judgment on it and on ourselves. It's far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically again and again, time without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a bright rainbow which you chase without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as actual things or places, they're always available and accompany you every instant. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom, and natural ease. Don't search any further. Don't go into the tangled jungle looking for the great awakened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own fireplace. Nothing to do or undo, nothing to force, nothing to want, and nothing missing. It's marvelous. Everything happens by itself.